What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Do you remember what I told you in the tunnel?
Yeah. It was noisy. I think you said something like, you should see the piano.
Remember what you told me?
I remember you were pointing my gun at me.
You said, I don't care.
Well, I saw the piano. Okay, Josh,
God.
You and Dr. Richard Kimball can come out of hiding so we can do this week's top five, the best movies of 1993.
Yes, finally a chance to talk about Hot Shots Part 2.
I can't wait.
We've also got a review of the new indie drama Short Term 12, starring Brie Larson, and we continue our Korean auteurs marathon with Hong Sang-soo's Woman on the Beach. That and more.
The piano's the one with Jeff Goldblum and all the dinosaurs, right?
Oh, boy. Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including two new $5 a month subscribers,
Taylor from Wilmette, Illinois, and Craig from Newcastle, Ohio,
plus a new Silver Club donor.
That would be Luke Hex from Melbourne, Australia.
Two other donors we want to thank this week, Alan in Holland Landing, Ontario, and Riley in Pennsylvania. We want to thank all of our new donors and our monthly subscribers. If you can't donate right now, but you still want to support the show, head over to iTunes, maybe give us a nice 5-star rating, or write a nice review of the show. You're listening to Film Spotting. Yes, it's been two decades since Steven Spielberg reanimated the dinosaurs and introduced us to Oscar Schindler. We'll count down our top five films of 1993 later in the show. You do realize, Josh, that I'm just going to spend the entire segment quoting from Tombstone, right?
I'm your Huckleberry, Adam. But first, our review of Short Term 12, an indie earning raves for its authenticity and especially its lead performance by Brie Larson.
Short Term 12, this is Grace. Remember, you're not their parent, you're not their therapist. You are here to create a safe environment, and that's it.
Got it.
Luis, you better be up.
As soon as I was gonna be.
Community meeting is now in session.
Slow this down a little bit. Yeah. Y'all ain't got no rhythm, man.
Mace, I love you like a brother, but I gotta say that when it come to being discreet, you're a disgrace.
I mean, he think we all don't know about him and Grace on the low, undercover trying to date.
Why are you so nice to me?
Well, it's easy. You are the weirdest, most beautiful person that I've ever met.
I often struggle with trying to determine what exactly makes a movie authentic. Is it a matter of budget, where the less a film spends, the more real it seems to us? Is it in the technique, you know, the shaky cam versus steady cam argument? Or is it in the performances, where authenticity means that we forget that the actors are acting at all? Or maybe this, maybe it's something more personal, so that my idea of an authentic movie is simply the accurate depiction of an experience I've actually had. These questions especially arose in regards to Short Term 12, which won two major awards at this year's South by Southwest. The movie gets its title from a foster care facility for at-risk teenagers where much of the drama takes place. Brie Larson plays Grace, the 20-something supervisor at this group home, which tries to create an oasis of sorts for the rotation of kids who are all recovering from one type of past trauma or another. There's certainly a real sense of authenticity here, partly due to the raw performances and partly due, I think, to writer-director Destin Cretton, who worked at a facility like this before making Short Term 12, which is his second feature film. Yet as much as I responded to these elements and would recommend the movie, I still sensed a faint whiff of what I can only call Hollywood in the air. And it kept me from embracing the movie as much as I wanted to, and certainly as much as others have. After wrestling with this a little bit, I think I've finally pinpointed where the issue is, at least for me. But I don't know if you had any such hesitations, Adam. Was Short Term 12 satisfyingly authentic for you, whatever that might mean?
Absolutely. It was indeed. And it's really funny that you're framing this discussion here to start the show this way, because we're going to end with a little bit of a conversation on authenticity when we get to our top five. That's how I framed my discussion of the number one film for me of 1993. So we're going to get into that a little bit more, I think, in terms of wrestling with what that means in terms of praise when you say something is truthful or say it's authentic, and why that's just immediately accepted as a positive when you describe something as authentic. So we'll get to that a little bit later. But the fact is, that is where I stand with this movie as well. there is a point. I think I probably know where you're going, Josh. There's a point where the plot in this film starts to click a little bit. After feeling like we're just kind of being shown this world, getting to live in it for a while, spend time with these characters, there is a moment where you recognize, oh yeah, there is a narrative here and some dominoes start to fall. And that's a common problem for me. It's something I've sat across from you here and complained about many times in a film where I love the first third or first two thirds, and then once the plot really kicks in, it all goes downhill. I absolutely didn't feel that way with this movie. I think it's really an issue of whether or not when that plot momentum starts, whether it feels organic. Was it set up right? Was it executed in a way that doesn't feel manipulative? And does it not push too hard? I think that's something this movie succeeds in. It has to feel as if all those plot machinations are born naturally out of choices the characters make, choices that feel authentic and resolve in ways that feel authentic. And that is, for me, exactly what happened here with Short Term 12.
So you're going to make me be the bad guy a little
bit
here. Well, and I do feel awful for offering anything but praise for this movie because it's so good-hearted. It's so hopeful. And these are things that I did admire about it, especially the lead characters, Grace, played by Brie Larson, in a really good performance, and also Mason, who's her romantic partner but also works with her at the facility. He's played by John Gallagher Jr., another good performance, mm-hmm. I would say. And these two, in their relationships with these kids, they care and care and care and care no matter what they get back, even though they often get anger back or rejection back. And that's certainly something you want to jump on board with and get into the flow of and get behind. As much as a movie can be a feel-good movie with this sort of subject matter,
right.
I think it is in some very honest ways. And so I do recognize that, and I did appreciate that. And just to jump back to the authenticity thing, I picked up on it as well in Cretton's camera work, particularly the way he was able to hold back from some situations. There are a lot of medium shots here, but are very carefully framed,
right.
So that we're looking maybe into one of these kids' rooms respectfully. We're seeing them from a respectful distance, learning about them, but not being intrusive.
Right.
That felt authentic to me. Some of the details he included. So those things did really work for me and are largely why overall, as I said, I would definitely suggest seeking this film out. I think you're right. I think you pinpointed where I did start to feel a little not manipulated. I don't think the movie goes that far, but I felt those gears. I felt the screenplay, or I felt more accurately the 3x5 note cards that were on the wall for the screenplay, because I could see the structure coming into place, as you said, and it was at odds with some of those other things that came before. Everything clicked together too perfectly and exactly when the story needed them. And even the paths of many of the characters intersected in very neat ways. So for me, it ended up being a movie that was far neater than any film set in such a place probably should be.
And obviously, I hear what you're saying, but I do think you're completely wrong. I can see how you think it's too neat. I would say it's neat, but not too neat. There's no doubt it all fits together. But as I said, in a way for me, that felt absolutely organic. And I think it is safe to call this movie well-crafted. And that can sometimes be a negative, actually. It can be kind of a pejorative thing because it hints at exactly what you're saying, Josh, that it seems too finely crafted. And sometimes a little mess is a good thing. I'd go back to one of the films from this year that I still wrestle with and talked about a little bit on our mid-year show about the best films of the year, The Place Beyond the Pines. That's a movie I loved the messiness of it. And I loved how early on some of the things did fit together. And then by the end, too much plot, too much tidiness, and it completely lost me. That never happened here with this movie, and we're on exactly the same page in terms of appreciating the camera work and the authenticity of it. I think it's also there in the script. I think there's no doubt it's there in the performances, but I like sort of the muted color palette of the camera, its positioning. I think you're absolutely right in terms of those medium shots and just the way it seems careful, but again, not too careful, and it doesn't go into too much of a cinema verite type realm. Yes, it's a little bit handheld at times. It feels like you're there. There's a little bit of a sense of urgency to it, but not so much that it feels like Cretton is trying to amp up the tension, make it feel more urgent or more realistic than it is. I don't think he needs to do that, and he doesn't. There's just nothing really wasted or gratuitous either way with the camera work here. And as I said, I do think the performances across the board, not just Brie Larson and John Gallagher Jr., but all these supporting performances hit every right note. And when I talk about it being finely crafted or well-crafted, what I mean there is that all those things are happening, But at the same time, it's a modest movie that's dealing with heavy subject matter. And if one of those parts were off, if the calibration just wasn't completely right, if one of the performances was too big, if there was an emotional beat too underlined, or it did get a little too ambitious in its plotting, which I think the movie is just ambitious enough, then it would all go wrong. As it is, I think Cretton is really reserved and ultimately truthful.
I think modest is a very good word for this film, and to its credit, definitely. I can see that, and I appreciated that about it. I'll also mention what could be seen as a screenwriting conceit that I think really worked, and it's the way he bookends the film.
Absolutely.
Wonderful opening scene to this movie, and maybe we'll just talk about that one and leave it up to those who see the movie to understand how the bookend works for the final scene. But at the opening, we see Grace and Mason giving this pep talk to a new employee there, played by Rami Malek.
And people will know from The Master.
Yeah.
Really distinct look. He
very
plays
distinct.
The son-in-law of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
It took
there.
Me about 30 seconds to place him, but yeah.
Yeah.
And he's good here. He's kind of the newbie, trying to feel his way, build relationships with these kids. And in, again, authentic, here's that word, ways that will also serve them and help lead them to the next phase in their life. And Mason is telling him this story about one confrontation he had earlier with one of the kids. And one of the current residents suddenly bursts out the door in the middle of the conversation, and they're just thrown into the chaos of this job.
Yeah.
And I loved how it places – we just learned so much in this really dramatic but not overinflated sequence about the setting, about the people working there, about the kids, and about the challenges they face and the way they're going about it. That is one key thing that did come out throughout this movie, is the attitude that it takes to not only endure in this job, but to really make a lasting difference in the lives of kids who are at risk in this way. It's not a punch the clock 9-to-5 thing. I mean, these two main characters, Grace and Mason, they live this stuff. They go home with it. And that's why they prove to be ultimately effective in these kids' lives.
Okay, what do we want to play for rec today?
Wiffle ball, dude.
Okay.
Oh, man. You're always playing that stupid game.
Because you always suck at it. Until you get good at it, maybe we can stop playing it.
Watch your mouth, bro.
Both of you, cut it out. Any other suggestions? Yes, Sammy?
Can we play big and small?
Is that a real game, or is that a game you just made up?
It's a real game that I just made up.
Okay. Well, maybe you can explain that to me later.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're discussing the new film, Short Term 12. I love that you bring up the beginning and end. Unfortunately, we can't really get into why the ending's so good. We just don't want to give away that final moment. But I do love the bookend, and I love that beginning for a couple of reasons. One is, I like the fact that there's some misdirection there on the writer and director's part. And I think there's a lot of misdirection in this movie that for me was really effective. It's what I mean when I say this film is one that could have gone down a lot of paths that felt cliche. And at times I felt those cliches kind of gnawing at me, thinking, oh, I know what's going to happen next, or I know where this development's going to lead. It never did for me. I was always surprised. And there's some misdirection there right in the beginning, I think. If you don't know anything about this film going in, if you're not tuned into the fact that Brie Larson's the main character, it's fair to assume that this new guy, Nate, who you mentioned, is probably going to be our hero. He makes sense as sort of our entree to this world, right? This is a story we've seen a million times. You throw the new character in, and we as an audience get to see this world and discover it through his eyes. And I thought that's where this film was going to go. But I think that would be that different movie, Josh, the one maybe falsely mining these kids' predicaments for whatever humor it could get out of it, the one falsely making tidy resolutions so we all get to leave the theater feeling like we just saw something really moving and something where we learn something about the world and ourselves, but we get to go on with our lives and feel like at least we don't have that job. I think other movies might have used the same material that way, and this movie doesn't. No, instead, this is a film that chooses to tell the story from the veteran's eyes. It tells it through Grace, who might even be more messed up than the kids are, but I even love how the movie takes that cliche potentially and introduces it in a way that is really deliberate and really discriminate in how they do it. And I thought ultimately effective. There's that word again. I also, Josh, love the beginning because it introduces us to a theme that's going to run throughout the whole film, which is the director really plays with different forms of expression. If you go back and think about the kids and also some of our main characters, all the different ways they express themselves through art, whether it's music or drawing or through just finally talking. There's a lot about the power of words here as well, and the sense that you do need to articulate your problem, and there's something that comes out of that that's constructive. And we also see on the flip side, Josh, all the characters who don't, all the withholding that goes on. But that opening scene where we meet Mason, think about it, right? Both of the bookends feature him blabbering on. He is someone who is an open book. All he does is talk and reveal, ultimately, too much information. He'll tell anything about
himself. He's kind of like the cuddly older brother. If you look at this group as a family, that's the role he plays, where he's protective. He's not really the enforcer, though you would think that might be his role, whereas Grace is, she plays a lot of different familial roles as well.
Absolutely.
She's the older sister, but also the mother when she needs to be. And I thought the dynamics of their relationships with the kids were very well done.
Yeah, and he's a character, Josh, as I was saying, who I think probably is on screen the healthiest adult figure we see, at least among those in that inner circle. And I think it does tie back into the fact that he's someone who's so willing to share of himself with other people and so willing to express himself. And you really can go through the movie and isolate all the different moments where someone finally kind of lets the floodgates out and is willing to express themselves, is willing to ultimately trust someone enough to express themselves. And there's even a great story at the end, which I'll just hint about, where we learn of a situation where a character really chooses his words carefully. And this whole idea about meaning what you say and having conviction behind it, not overdoing it, and how powerful that can be. So the movie does play with that in a lot of different ways. At the same time, it also shows you the power of actions. There is a time where a character just has to finally let out all the anger and frustration and resentment she's feeling. It can't always be just about the words. Sometimes you do have to express it in other ways. So I thought that conceit, the way it was held throughout this entire movie, was interesting, even down to that character you mentioned, who we are introduced to at the beginning, Sam, a character who is a young boy, and we get some hints about why he's there. And this just seems to be a regular sort of occurrence for him where he tries to escape. And he just yells and screams and vents. And you know what? Sometimes that just has to be done.
And I love how they hold him down and recognize that. And those are very effective scenes as well. When one of the kids does have some sort of violent outburst, how Grace and Mason deal with that and let them process that. And that's, again, not inflated at all, as you were talking about Cretton's style. He doesn't inflate those scenes, which could be very volatile, could be very emotional. It's almost, I don't want to say documentary-like, but it does have much more of that feel than it does some sort of hyper-emotional drama.
Right. Yeah, it really does. And I think you are hitting on something accurate as well, of course, when you talk about the different familial roles that are shown in this movie, or at least the different ways characters have to care for other people. Because when you really do break it down, much more than being a film about expression and the need for trust is the way it explores the different parental roles. I mean, you can watch scene after scene where I started to notice that clear pattern of characters literally sometimes becoming parents and having to wrestle with that, figuratively playing parental roles. As you said, the Brie Larson character, Grace, has become largely a mother figure to a lot of these people, but she's also a sister. She takes on a lot of different roles. But we also see the real bad side. We do see examples of parents who do the wrong thing, or we hear stories about parents who are doing exactly the wrong thing. We also see some parents who have done the right thing. The film explicitly deals with that idea of what kind of a parent kids need or should have.
So we're talking a lot about good things we see happening in this group home for these kids and how the movie handles that well. I do wonder if it might have been enriched by a little more pain, in a sense, which seems like an unhealthy thing to say, because there's certainly plenty of pain here. But what you just said reminded me of it. We hear about it in the past. So we're kind of in this oasis, which I think is the movie's intent, and it handles that well. But I also wonder if it speaks to a sense of wish fulfillment that the movie has a little bit in wanting so much to get to the healing of these kids, or the moving on of these kids to a better place, which you can't help but want. And you want to see that I sensed a little bit that the actual hurt was left behind. I don't want to actually watch any of that happen, but to me, it might have provided a little more balance to the film if we had seen some of that and experienced some of that in a way that was done as effectively as we feel the togetherness that they have and the healing that they have.
See, I think it's there. I think it's there on Brie Larson's face. I think it's in her reactions. I think it's in some of her, I guess you can call them obsessive compulsive traits, or maybe just the way she sometimes hurts herself by picking at her nail. I think it's in her behavior. I really see that pain, and the fact that it's something that even at the end of the film, when some healthy steps have been taken to point her in the right direction to express herself, you get the sense that this fight is far from over.
It's a
That's
journey.
How I felt.
It's this a journey.
Is gonna be
a journey. Sure.
And it's going to be that journey for all of them. I think, again, that speaks to what we love so much about the bookend, too, that there's a certain cycle here that can't be avoided, even as it ends on a hopeful note. And maybe it's just that I was so tuned into this movie and I wanted to see these characters come out on the good side, that I was rooting for it to be hopeful. But I don't begrudge the film being hopeful if I feel like it earned it and it didn't feel false, if it did feel authentic. And the way it feels authentic is by giving you the sense that not everyone's problems have been solved overnight.
It has this irrepressible expression of hope that I'll certainly admit is very hard to resist.
Short Term 12 is out now in limited release, including playing right here in Chicago. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Listeners choose the one 1993 movie they'd save in the Film Spotting poll up next. Though, Adam, do you realize we forgot to include Super Mario Brothers as an option?
Throw the poll out.
Plus the second film in our Korean auteurs marathon, Woman on the Beach. Stay with us.
Why the obsession with Iraq and Saddam?
Well, you love that word, obsession. I can see the glow in your face when you say it.
Well, I'm an obsessive person.
Are you? I'm not. I'm cool. I'm measured.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Errol Morris with Donald Rumsfeld in Errol Morris's new documentary about the former Secretary of State, specifically his role in the invasion of Iraq. We're going to get to a poll question a little bit later, previewing the upcoming Chicago International Film Festival, our top five that's going to be coming up on our next show, highlighting our most anticipated movies of the festival. We'll see if that movie from Errol Morris makes the cut. Right now, though, it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this.
How well do you know me?
Grandpa. Not that well, apparently.
Do you know me well enough that if I did something that looked a little strange and was maybe even a little bit dangerous, but I told you to trust me anyway, that you could do that?
No.
Wow, that was honest. You're beautiful, you're kind, and you're painfully honest.
Who are you? What did you do with Sean Fentress?
It's the new me.
That was Jake Gyllenhaal as Coulter Stevens. Of course, he's also playing Sean Fentress here, with Michelle Monaghan as Christina Warren in Source Code from 2011, written by Ben Ripley and directed by Duncan Jones.
Jay in Cincinnati, Ohio, explained the tie-in to our last show where you heard my quick conversation with Sam Rockwell. He says there were a few tie-ins to Sam Rockwell. Source Code was directed by Duncan Jones, whose previous film was Moon. That, of course, starred Sam Rockwell. Eric Knox, the name you substituted in the scene, was the character Rockwell played in Charlie's Angels. Happily, I had to Google that one, Jay says. Also, Jeffrey Wright had a supporting role in Source Code, and Wright appears in the new movie A Single Shot, starring Rockwell. In fact, I did talk with Mr. Rockwell specifically about acting opposite Jeffrey Wright, who is in Source Code and somehow manages to chew just a little bit less scenery than he does in his new film, A Single Shot. Thank you, Jay, for that. If you want to hear that scene and my talk with Mr. Rockwell, along with our DVD release roundup from last show, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or access it via iTunes. Josh, not many people recognize the scene. I knew it would be tough. I didn't think it would be quite that tough. One of the lowest number of entries ever for Massacre Theater.
I think a lot of people still have to see Source Code.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It didn't do very well at the box office.
It did not do very well.
I didn't understand when it came out. Got a glowing review here on the show. Really worth seeing.
And it's very entertaining.
Yeah.
And the people who have seen it are passionate about it, but there's not enough of them.
There you go. So not enough people entering Massacre Theater either, but we do have enough to pick out a winner. Reach in and pick it out.
The winner would be Kevin Ragland from Richmond, Virginia.
Congratulations, Kevin. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free six-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Martin, look at me.
I am looking at you.
Now look at me the way I'm looking at you. Put it in your eyes. You're mine, ass, without saying it.
How about this?
What are you telling me? Are you sleepy? That you want to go to bed?
Time now for Massacre Theater. I tried my best to give Adam the juicy part this week, but he just wouldn't take it.
You were born for this role.
Well, we'll see about that. Massacre Theater is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information is at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners will get the first 30 days free.
And a quick recommendation, if you are going over to Fandor.com/filmspotting and seeing what they have available, I've been very curious for a while now about this film, Sun Don't Shine, from this past year. It's the feature directing debut from Amy Simetz, who is the co-star of Shane Carruth in Shane Carruth's movie Upstream Color. She's very good as an actress in that movie, and this is a movie she directed. It's about a road trip. I think that's all I'll say. Our very own friend of Film Spotting, Michael Phillips, described it as a swampy badlands for the 21st century. Well, that sounds pretty great. And I know it has gotten some very good reviews. So if you're curious about Sun Don't Shine, want to check that out again, that's Fandor.com/filmspotting. Okay. We haven't really prepared as usual. We haven't practiced the scene, and maybe we should have, because there's a lot of language here that really is not suitable for our radio audience. Maybe not even suitable for our podcast audience and all the adults listening to the show.
We're multiple pairs of earmuffs,
yeah,
I think, are needed.
We're going to dance around it as best we can. And yes, you are definitely getting the good role here.
All right.
Are you ready?
Let's see.
I started off, so you're going to give me the action.
And action.
Mr. Roma. This is the second time you turned me down for a drink, man. What, you don't like my champagne?
Hey, could be.
I don't know. Maybe there's a mis-effing understanding. I don't know, man. Maybe you don't remember me. My name.
Maybe I don't give a shit. Maybe I don't remember the last time I blew my nose either. Who the F are you? I should remember you, huh? What, you think you're like me? You ain't like me, mother effer. You a punk. I've been with made people, connected people. Who you been with? Chain, snatch, and jive, ass miracle, mother effers. Why don't you get lost? Go ahead, snatch a purse. Come on, take a effing walk.
And scene. How does your throat feel after that? You did go to your go-to Josh growl there.
The growl?
I have to say.
You know what? That actually reminded me of a few things I said to you when you first approached me about coming on the show.
That's true.
Remember that conversation?
Actually, it did feel a little bit like that.
I swore a little bit more, though.
I had to improve my champagne offerings, unfortunately. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Yes, there is a tie-in to this week's show. The deadline is Monday, September 30th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
It looks like it has a cold.
Yeah, maybe.
Can I touch it?
Sure. Just think of it as kind of a big cow.
I like cows.
A scene there from Steven Spielberg's 1993 movie Jurassic Park. We are going to share our top five films of 1993 coming up a bit later in the show, and anticipating this week's top five, Josh, on our last show, we asked our listeners which one movie from 1993 they could save. Only one. Aliens are going to come down. They're going to destroy every film that was ever made from 1993, but you can save one. Which one is it? We gave you these choices, and only five choices. Obviously, there are a lot of good movies from 1993, as you're going to hear when we get to our selections, but we gave you these. Dazed and Confused, Groundhog Day, Jurassic Park, Schindler's List, or the Tony Scott-directed, Quentin Tarantino-penned True Romance. Josh, how did it come out?
A real surprise for me, at least in last place here, with only 10% of the vote, True Romance.
So apparently Lost Forever, Gary Oldman as the pimp, Drexel Spivey. Okay,
yeah,
fine.
Indeed.
He's gone.
16% of the vote went to Dazed and Confused.
Nicky Catt as a bully in that film. Wooderson, Matthew McConaughey, gone forever.
All gone. 20% went to Schindler's List.
Man, Ralph Fiennes as Amon Goeth.
Although that was also tied with the other Spielberg film, Jurassic Park received 20% too.
I guess we're going to lose the dinosaurs one more time. They're extinct.
Which means Groundhog Day was saved, 33% of the vote.
Not a surprise here. Film Spotting listeners adore this movie. It's come up again and again.
But more than true, much more than True Romance.
I guess so. Huh. Much, much more. It wasn't that tough. So saved for all eternity. I Got You, Babe.
Oh, boy.
And Punxsutawney Phil from Groundhog
Day. You put it that way.
We got this feedback. Elijah Davidson, he really parsed this poll question here, Josh, which I can appreciate. He says, Schindler's List is a masterpiece. Jurassic Park sparked a technological revolution and earned Spielberg Universal's graces to make Schindler's List. Dazed and Confused signaled the emergence of a new auteur. The selling of True Romance's script reportedly financed Reservoir Dogs. But if we lost any of those films, what would we really lose? We'd still have Reservoir Dogs. We'd still have all of Linklater's other work. We'd still have Jurassic Park 2, 3, and soon 4. While Schindler's List is remarkable, we'd still have lots of films about the Holocaust. If Groundhog Day goes away, we'd lose something singular. We'd lose one of the most romantic, humorous, dark, and profound films ever made. There's nothing else like it, and there never will be anything else like it ever again. Save Groundhog Day, Elijah Davidson says.
I like Elijah's thinking.
He may have got T-shirts printed. Wow.
He's got a campaign going, huh? Jen agreed with him. Jen from Chicago said, without a doubt, Groundhog Day. Infinitely quotable, infinitely rewatchable. Smart and funny, with a sneakily profound message that it's not about getting the girl, it's about being the best version of yourself. Doesn't hit you over the head, but just does its thing. And I may be the only person here who feels this way, but I just can't get behind Schindler's List. I know it's important. I know it was well acted and beautifully photographed, but I remember being deeply angry after watching it. I remember thinking, this is a story about the Holocaust made palatable for non-Jews. I didn't expect to feel so alienated from my own cultural history by a movie that seemed to have the goal of documenting and preserving that history. The final scene was the one that made me angry. Poor Schindler felt guilty. He couldn't save everyone, but the Jews forgave him. Hooray, ugh.
There's definitely that school of thought.
Oh, yeah.
There. A lot of people out there against Schindler's List as well. So definitely not alone there. I'm going to make a lot of listeners angry with my top five with all that love for Groundhog Day, though.
You're going to, I'm
expecting the emails. There's a little tease there. Dan Buckler from Milwaukee says, Jurassic Park was the first film I remember seeing in the theaters. 20 years later, I was fortunate enough to revisit Jurassic Park on the big screen for the re-release this past summer, and it awed me all over again. No other film before or since has evoked such wonder as Jurassic Park did for me as a 6 and 26-year-old. It's a nostalgic pick, but not one that reminds me of my personal past, but a more universal nostalgia because the film can replicate the sheer curiosity, wonder, and terror of childhood fantasy. Groundhog Day is hilarious and Schindler's List is haunting, but there are other films that induce those reactions. The wonderment of realistic dinosaurs and the peril of the people in front of them is unique. There's absolutely a debate as to the best film of 1993, but if we were only to save one film, well, I want everybody in the future to get a chance to see Jurassic Park.
See, this brings up that interesting question of nostalgia, because we were talking about where Jurassic Park stands in terms of the Spielberg films that we'd probably describe similarly that came earlier during our childhood, Raiders or something like that. And to me, those are the ones that capture this sense of wonder better than Jurassic Park. But maybe that's just because I was a kid when I saw them.
Exactly.
So,
Dan was 6 when he saw Jurassic Park.
Right, right.
We were 18, 19, completely different situation.
So how do you set that aside and just look at the films? Hard to do. Eva from Salzburg, Austria said, that is a mean question. My favorite film on this list is Jurassic Park. No contest there. Asking me to save just one film, however, makes me think my choice should be influenced by something weightier and more mature than just, God, I love dinosaurs. So for this reason, I'm picking Schindler's List, because if I can save just one film from this year, it should be the one that says there's still some good left in humanity, even at the darkest of times, instead of, ooh, T-Rex, or, shit, it's still February 2nd. That's where you land on Groundhog Day, huh, Adam?
Just maybe. We'll see. We'll get there, Josh. Don't jump ahead. Paco Casablanca, which I hope that's his name. I think we've heard from Paco before, and it is fun to say whether it's true or not. He writes, it was easy to narrow it down to two. I recently revisited both of Spielberg's 1993 efforts, and while I think they held up, I didn't find myself blown away. True Romance I find garish and flashy, not in a good way. So it came down to two of the decade's greats for me, Dazed and Confused and Groundhog Day. Both are hilarious, both held up, and both are the pinnacle of their genres. I gave the edge to Dazed and Confused because, well, Linklater is the man. Ramis, not so much. And later, Paco did wonder in the poll question, how is Dazed and Confused not winning? I thought this was Linklater Nation. I, too, thought this was Linklater Nation. We'll see if I can reclaim some of that for Mr. Linklater as we get to the top five. Why don't you close with the last word here from Chris Massa? He's in Pittsburgh.
This is a tough one for me, tough enough that I'm going to give a few different answers, depending on how the question is interpreted. If the question is, you can only save one movie from 1993 to put on repeat and watch again and again and again, it's a toss-up between Jurassic Park and Groundhog Day. Both are fun, energetic, and infinitely rewatchable. If the question is, you can only save one movie from 1993 to put in a time capsule, it would be Schindler's List. It's not my favorite Spielberg, but it's a movie that deserves to be seen for generations to come, as a great work of art, as a word of warning, and as a reminder of how much good one person can do in the face of evil. If the question is, you can only save one movie from 1993 that's not on this list, my answer is Martin Scorsese's The Age of Innocence, in my opinion, an overlooked masterpiece.
Okay, so obviously, Chris, rewriting the poll there, fair enough. We like to do that from time to time ourselves. Thanks to everyone who voted in that poll and shared some of your comments. We do hope you'll go to filmspotting.net this week and answer this question as we are setting up the upcoming Chicago International Film Festival. And Josh, I'm going to say it. This one, I think, is probably just as tough as the 1993 question. It really is. Sam, our producer, has really outdone himself with it. As we're looking ahead to some of the films that are considered special presentations, we're asking you, which of these performances are you most interested in seeing? So a little bit different, and I think maybe a little bit tougher than if you were just picking the films, because sometimes a subpar sounding film can have an actor you love or an actor you like doing something that seems really interesting for him or her. So let's see how this one comes out. The choices are
Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge in Alan Partridge. He'll be reprising his well-loved TV character there. Benedict Cumberbatch as Julian Assange in Bill Condon's The Fifth Estate. Idris Elba as Nelson Mandela in Mandela Long Walk to Freedom. Meryl Streep is an option here as Violet Weston. This is from the film adaptation of Tracy Letts' Pulitzer Prize-winning play, August, Osage County. Or lastly here, Donald Rumsfeld as himself. He's in Errol Morris's new documentary about Rumsfeld, The Unknown Known.
Okay, we've been withholding our answers here to not skew the results at all, maybe influence our listeners. But I can't help it, Josh. I want to weigh in on this one. I don't know if you've thought about it. Of these five, because this is tough. If you leave out Donald Rumsfeld and you just look at the actors, Coogan, Cumberbatch, Idris Elba, and Meryl Streep, I mean, those are four pretty formidable performers. I want to see what all of them are going to do next. So it's a very tough question. I do nevertheless have an answer. Where do you come out?
Can I say that the actors are more intriguing to me than the roles, actually?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not familiar with Alan Partridge, so I have to kind of set that aside. And Cumberbatch and Elba are playing real-life characters. I always have a little bit of a hesitancy about getting excited about that. So that leaves Meryl Streep, which is definitely intriguing to me. But my pick is going to be Rumsfeld, just because can Errol Morris actually get him to play himself? I mean, this is a guy who just seems to be behind such a wall, and you know that Morris is able to break those down. I can't wait to see how that works here.
Well, you broke it down perfectly. I'm exactly with you.
All right.
Thought we were going to differ, but Donald Rumsfeld was my vote as well. So let's see what listeners think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, that's where you can occasionally, Josh, get information about free movie passes. Sometimes we have advanced screenings coming up and we give away some Admit 2 passes to those screenings. And Magnolia Pictures is releasing a new music documentary called Muscle Shoals. It opens at the Landmark here in Chicago on Friday, October 4th. It's a documentary that traces the evolution of the Muscle Shoals sound studio and its impact on the industry. Mick Jagger is featured in it, Alicia Keys, among many others. And on Thursday night, just the night before it opens, there's going to be a 7 p.m. free screening of that movie. We're giving away passes. All you got to do is go to filmspotting.net and you'll see the link right there in the top stories if you do live in the Chicago area and want to seek that film out. Also wanted to throw out a quick plug for a movie, Josh. I think on last week's show, as we were going through the new releases, I may have just glossed over completely, but it's a new film about the Federal Reserve called Money for Nothing Inside the Federal Reserve. It's narrated by Liev Schreiber and it's an independent film. It's trying to take a non-biased look at the role of the Fed and the impact on our lives. And the director of the movie, Jim Bruce, happens to be a Film Spotting listener and did write in encouraging people, as you would expect, to give his movie a shot. So if that is a film that you may be interested in based on the subject matter, you can learn more at moneyfornothingthemovie.org. And I do think it is being held over and playing another week here in Chicago, but I can't say that with 100% certainty. The best thing to do if you are interested in more information, again, is to go to that website. We'll link to it in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net.
독일에서는 얼마나 있었어요?
오래 있었어요.
독일어 잘하시겠네요.
거기 산 만큼이에요.
잘해요.
That's Kim Sung-woo as Director Kim with Go Hyun-young and Kim Tae-woo sharing a meal and a conversation in the second film in our Korean auteurs marathon, the second of six movies in the marathon, Woman on the Beach from director Hong Sang-soo. It's his seventh feature film. And there were many choices of his that listeners recommended, Josh. It was very hard to pick one of his films. And this is a movie that I think I was probably sucked into or beguiled by based on the description, because you learn that it's about a director who is working on a screenplay.
Really? That appealed to you?
And yes, as many listeners know, movies about the artistic process, specifically often movies about movies, are movies that tend to attract me. So I was sucked in for that reason. And if you watch Woman on the Beach, it reminds me a lot in some ways. I wonder if anyone else ever made this comparison to the Before Sunrise movies, because there's a lot of walking and talking and people in relationships. The difference here is there's often a third wheel, but usually they're trying to get it pared down to just two people. So there's a lot of scenic locations, walking on the beach or going to meals or going to have a drink and talking. And often they're talking about relationships. And I'm tempted to ask you, Josh, whether or not this film intrigued you anywhere near as much as some of those Before movies. But really, I'm going to go back to this notion of choosing this film, because as I brought up with the first film in our marathon, which was a movie called Three Iron by Kim Ki-duk, it turns out in our research, this was the first film we'd seen by that director. We learned that he's a filmmaker known for being hyper-violent and really kind of a misanthrope, is the way many people regard him and say his movies are not very redeeming. And
we picked find, his sweet
yeah,
fable.
Yeah, we find his sweet fable. We find the movie that has sort of humanist intentions and does have a little bit of that sadism and masochism to it, but just there a little bit. Ultimately, it does seem like a pretty sweet movie. So it seems as if we chose correctly, especially if you consider we did ultimately both like the movie and recommended it. I'm curious if you think we chose correctly here, because this is a movie from a director who I know so many Film Spotting listeners who revere this filmmaker, Hong Sang-soo. One of them in particular is a listener named Sean Gilman, who's a member of our Film Spotting Advisory Board, helps us out from time to time with top five list ideas and such. And he's a guy who I call the dean of the Film Spotting Forum, very learned man who has seen probably 2,000 more movies than either of us have. And he loves this director. And I only learned after the fact that he rates Woman on the Beach as the 10th best of his 12 movies. So should we have listened more closely to Sean? Could we have possibly picked a better representative from Hong Sang-soo than Woman on the Beach? Or did we choose correctly once again?
It's so hard to say because we don't know what the other options are. You know, one of the goals is to kind of get a general overview of recent Korean cinema. So that doesn't allow us to do an auteur approach to these films, which would be a great way to go about it. We just chose differently. I guess if you use the measurement of how did you respond to the film? Then I don't think we chose very well, because I didn't have a good reaction to this movie. And it's interesting that you bring up Linklater, because one of the things he is often criticized for mildly is that his movies, especially the Before films, perhaps until this last one, aren't very visually interesting or striking or do anything that grabs you from that sense, that filmmaking aspect. And Hong Sang-soo, based on this film, makes Linklater look like a visual genius. And I wrestled with this because there were clear decisions that were being made here. It wasn't that I found the filmmaking inept. It was just the style he chose, which to me is very basic, very dreary, did not really add to the experience or the narrative or the story or the other things the movie was interested in. And one example I'll use, there are frequent zooms in the film, mm-hmm. which I've learned afterwards is a trademark of his. And often these will be medium shot scenes where people are at a table talking, and we'll get them from a fair distance away and we'll zoom in maybe 10 seconds after the scene has begun, maybe 20 seconds closer to them. And it will stop there. There's other moments, just a small thing, just to give an example, early on where three characters are traveling in a car down the road and the camera pans along as they're going. A normal shot stops. The car continues. We wait a few seconds more and then it pans over a little bit more to capture the sign to show us where we're going. Now, mm-hmm. these may seem like small things, but to me, they took me out of the movie, or at least certainly didn't add to the story in any way. Now, I know that there can be very distinctive uses for long unbroken shots that I do appreciate. They emphasize a sense of space. They give room for performances to breathe. But here, again, the spaces, this is a beachside resort where this is taking place, and there's not much visually interesting there in the landscapes even, especially if you compare it to something like a beach scene that came to mind to me was To the Wonder, which had a lot of also walking along the tide scenes. And this film doesn't take advantage negatively or positively. I don't mean it has to look pretty. I just mean it doesn't take advantage of that landscape to me in an interesting way. And as for the performances, I found these to be pretty strident.
Yeah.
So to me, it wasn't an advantage to have these actors go on and on. They could have, to my mind, benefited perhaps from some edits that would have broken up the performances a little bit and worked to their advantage.
Yeah. I think as someone noted in the comments on Letterboxd when you posted your review, I saw the conversation there.
Yeah, we had a good conversation about it.
Someone rightfully noted, I think, that the Zooms are effective. And Sean was part of it. The Zooms are effective when they're doing something very specific in this movie, which is when they're excluding someone from the conversation, which, as I said, there's often three characters in a scene, but it's about pairing off and trying to lose one of those characters. So the Zooms can be effective when they are literally removing that character from the frame. But I also think there are times where Hong Sang-soo does it with the frame itself, and you just feel them outside the frame. We don't need the Zoom at all, and those shots are also effective. I think for me, I'm with you, Josh. Too often, all the Zooms do here in this movie is put too fine a point on something as if it's singling out to you, okay, this is something important. This is going to be a key bit of dialogue here. I'm going to zoom in on it. That's how it felt to me, because every moment where it did zoom in, that was where we got some kind of nugget that you could argue was an important bit being shared with these people. Not that a lot of their conversations are anything more than pretty mundane, and I think that's kind of the point, but it seemed to be those instances where they were striving for some kind of profundity or trying to express something truly about themselves. I wish I could argue with you about this movie. I really wish I could. It'd probably be a more fun listen, but I'm afraid I'm with you right down the line, and I do feel bad that we didn't listen to Sean better as our Hong Sang-soo expert, because as you said, we don't know for sure, haven't seen any of his other films, but the fact that he put this one at number 10 suggests to me maybe we aren't that far off, and we could have probably chosen a lot more wisely. And it did feel to me at times like one of the Before Sunrise movies, except with less interesting looking shots. And I'm one of those people who tried during a Before Midnight review to kind of defend the way Linklater uses the camera in those Before movies, in all three of those films. But not only here are the shots less visually stimulating, but the people on screen, the characters themselves, are a lot less stimulating. And you're right, lots of directors use similarly long takes. Lots of directors use similarly static shots. So why do these particular shots feel so much less interesting than other filmmakers that use some of these, including zooms from time to time? A guy I'm thinking of is Woody Allen. I don't really have a solid answer to it, Josh. I haven't thought about it enough. I did just see this movie a few hours ago before coming here, but I would also say maybe I need to wrestle with some more of his films. I like to see how Hong Sang-soo uses it in other movies to really try to pinpoint how it can be more effective. You're right. It's clearly a stylistic choice, but the best I can do at trying to getting at why it didn't do anything for me might be just to express the fact that there's really nothing at stake in terms of what's happening between any of these characters in the frame at any given point. There's really no sense of wondering whether any of these people are going to end up together or care if they end up together. And I think that's kind of the point. I think to some extent, and we'll talk about it maybe a little bit more when we get into some of the themes of the film, that may be the entire point that Hong Sang-soo is trying to make. But nevertheless, there's really little to grasp onto, and I didn't have any investment whatsoever in these characters. I simply didn't find any of them interesting to watch on screen, and if none of them are interesting as individuals, then there's not really anything for me to care about in terms of whether or not they make connections with other people.
Well, see, this is where I thought you might have been able to find a hook, actually, because as you mentioned, films about the creative process and filmmakers interest you. I have a little bit of a resistance for those. Not that I write them off immediately, but it's just not as inherently compelling to me. And here, what we get is really a play on 8.5 in a little bit, which is one of your favorite films. The director who's, you know, hit a writer's block and can't get through. And one of the ways he processes that, a main way, is through women, a rotation of women. And we have this a little bit here with the lead character, director Kim. He first meets, initially, it is a trio, as you talked about, three people going on this trip to the beach. It's director Kim, his friend, and then the woman who is purportedly the friend's girlfriend, the female lead, played by Go Hyun-jung. So they're on this trip together, and pretty soon this love interest makes it clear that she's not really with director Kim's friend, and she makes herself available to him. And so they jump into this relationship. And part of the story is whether or not he's going to complete this screenplay and how their relationship will service that end. And this gets accentuated later on in the film when they separate for reasons and director Kim pursues another woman played by Song Sen-mi, who serves the same purpose. And he talks about how they look alike.
Yeah,
the two women look alike. And so
she's a stand-in.
So there's just, you know, there's some distaste I have for that entire conceit, which is a repeated one we see in cinema from 8.5 all the way through to this. It's just not that compelling to me. And the movie doesn't really add anything to what is a very familiar and tiresome conceit.
Yeah, I agree with you. Ultimately, though, I think to really underline the difference between this movie and one like Fellini's 8.5, you articulated some of the similarities, but I don't think you can compare the camera work or visually.
Oh, no,
of
no.
course, what Fellini's doing, I know you're not. I'm just going to illustrate why a film like 8.5 is one I revere. It was in my top 10 films
of all
time.
Has so much more going on.
Right, visually, in terms of the truth that comes through in the performances, the stakes, it's truly life or death, whether or not he's going to be able to finish his film. And there is so much more of a struggle, I think, in terms of that conflict with his relationship to women. There's a struggle here as well. There's a little bit of self-loathing, I think, that does come through in this director Kim character. Not as much, though, as we get in the Mastroianni character from 8.5, which maybe there's not a more self-loathing character in the history of cinema, so that makes sense. But one of the things I guess I would say in defense of this movie that I did kind of like is I wonder if there's something simply new, if you will, or noble in this filmmaker making a movie about an artist, someone who could clearly be seen as a stand-in for him, which is going to happen anytime a writer-director makes a movie about a writer-director and that creative process, and makes them truly uninteresting and at times a little bit reprehensible. I love the fact that there is a line late in the movie where that love interest character says to him, "I really liked you as a movie director." And there is a sense that as a movie director, as someone you see from afar, or as someone you regard a certain way, you build up a certain image of them. But the reality is much more mundane and boring and uninteresting and actually bad. And that's a conceit that is played with many times in this film. So in some ways, it almost comes off on the director's part as an apology. If you're going to equate him with the director in real life, which I don't know if you can, but you could read it as him saying, look, if you get to know me, I'm actually pretty tedious and annoying. I'm not really a good guy. And yet all these people look to me for guidance or think I have some kind of answers. I'm not that good of a person. And I love actually that character also puts it really well, the way she describes him early in the film. She nails him, Josh, perfectly. She says, you're not a bad person, basically. You're reckless, but not loathsome. And that's true. He's truly reckless with everyone around him, the way he regards everyone, with how he behaves himself, how he treats himself and others. But he's not a loathsome character. And maybe there's something refreshing enough in that. Because, yes, you get a lot of cad characters in the way directors are often portrayed on screen. But I don't know if you see someone who's really is as uninteresting, for lack of a better word, as this guy.
There's certainly some self-critique going on here. And that was one of the defenses that was brought up on that comment thread on Letterboxd.
I didn't see that.
And, you know, so even though I see that there, I have to wonder, isn't there still, even if this character is supposed to be a stand-in of some sort, to some degree, to the director, isn't there still a level of self-indulgence to self-critique at heart when you're doing it at this level, when you're making an entire feature film about it, and that is the main gist? I mean, to me, even though I can understand that there is a level of self-loathing involved, I still push back a little bit by the indulgence that goes into that. And I think it's not as pointed as maybe some of the film's admirers would argue, simply because we do get at the end, I wouldn't say triumphant, but the narrative does come around to the completion of this screenplay. And the moment is it's comic when he does complete it. You can see that it's kind of enjoying the completion, yet also making fun of his enjoyment of the completion of the screenplay. Yet we're still left with him heading back from the beach with that screenplay done as if that's all that mattered. And I have to feel, to me, I didn't feel all that much self-critique at that point.
Well, I got to be honest. I didn't feel like that was much of a moment at all. I don't feel like the movie cared.
Well, there aren't many moments in this film
but
of any sort.
I really don't think it cares if he finishes the script at all. As he says, in fact, it might suck when I read it tomorrow. And our sense, having watched this guy for 2 hours and 20 minutes on screen or whatever it is, it probably does suck. Because
you didn't go for his description of it?
No.
That didn't hook you in?
Well, I will say this. I actually did kind of like his description. I kind of wanted to see that movie when he gets into some detail about this whole mystical thing going on. And I'll give this movie credit as well for the fact that if we ever do a top five best uses of a diagram to map out the main character's worldview and possibly that of the director's, this is going in the top five. It's a very specific, nuanced list, Josh. I don't know if we'll actually get
many good options. Show 738, I predict.
There is a scene where he lays it all out there. And you know what? That notion that he gets at there, and I really can't articulate it at all, but it does make its own kind of mystical, absurd sense. It seems to be that this movie is interested in this notion of repetition. You've talked a little bit about characters, images, motifs. We see a lot of things recur that are similar, but sometimes they're slightly different or there's slightly different circumstances. But it seems to be Hong Sang-soo wants to show us the same thing, but show us in a slightly different way and make us reconsider it. Unfortunately, as we've both said now multiple times, if you don't find any of the images themselves particularly compelling or the characters, it's hard to really take a whole lot in. And there's a scene, for example, like the one where he goes searching for a replacement, if you will, or he doesn't really go searching. He just happens upon this woman
right.
who he sees, and maybe it's a conquest, maybe it's just a pickup line, or maybe he's truly trying to find the doppelganger answer to the love interest that went home earlier. He finds this girl and he says, "Can I interview you?" And he starts asking her these really mundane questions, just really basic, run-of-the-mill, kind of everyday life kind of things. And at one point, she really reveals something about herself, and she starts to cry. And that's actually one of the purest moments in this movie for me. That really worked because I love this notion of how sometimes the most mundane circumstances can produce something powerful, that something really interesting and informative about someone can come out in an interpersonal exchange like that, that really wasn't necessarily going for it, but it just organically happens. I wish there were more moments like that in the movie. Unfortunately, there aren't.
If you're looking, if you're looking for that to be the sort of payoff from all the mundane scenes, maybe that is the only one you get.
We've mentioned those comments on Letterboxd a couple times, and we'll link to that in our show notes if you want to check it out. I did see where Peter Labuza linked to a Chicago critic, Ignaty Vyshnovetsky, who has written a lot about Hong Sang-soo. And he does say something about the way he uses two shots with conversations that I think has to be reckoned with. He makes the point that with his conversations and those static framing, that more than any other filmmaker, what's really being emphasized there is the distance between the two people. And whether you want to buy that or not, something he says that I think objectively you have to accept is he points out that if you really do go back and watch virtually every conversation seen in Woman on the Beach, they aren't really ever conversations. People in this film don't actually have much of an interplay of ideas. No one picks up on what someone said and bounces off it.
No, they
it's
don't
always
respond.
People
yeah.
talking at each other.
Yep.
They each sort of get their moment to say something, and the other person then says what they want to say, and they never really do connect. And so if you want to put that in terms of his larger body of work, which we can't do,
right.
Ignaty can, that's an insight he has, and maybe as we watch more of his films, we'll come to some of those insights as well. That is Woman on the Beach, the second film in our Korean auteurs marathon. We're going to get to the third film. Our plan is next week. It is I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay.
That sounds
right. Is
that
what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
It's Park Chan-wook's film, the guy who gave us Old Boy and the Revenge trilogy, also the recent film Stoker. And this was going to be later in the marathon. We've bumped it up because one of our listeners rightfully noted that it's leaving Netflix Instant on October 1st.
Yeah, I'm glad they pointed that out.
Yeah, so if you are following along or you want to follow along and want to watch that movie, your last chance is October 1st. So if you're hearing this, hopefully you have a little bit of time to watch it there.
1993. I was a wide-eyed college freshman. Adam was a know-it-all high school senior. What are our favorite movies from that formative year? The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
We sort of breezed through the donations there at the top of the show after the billboard. Josh, did want to take a moment to share some of those listener comments, as we do every week, from our new donors, including Craig in Newcastle, Ohio, who not only signed up to be a $5 a month donor, but also sent us a Silver Club donation. And he included these comments.
Figured if I'm going to tweet at you when I disagree with your takes here and there, oh, that's you, Craig. The least I could do is send a donation your way. I also signed up to contribute $5 a month so I can continue to throw verbal jabs at you guilt-free.
Absolutely. You pay, you can say whatever you want.
There you go. The first show I listened to was number 369, Remakes, with your reviews of The Thing and Footloose. I figured I'd give film spotting a few more tries before deciding whether to keep up with the podcast. All these episodes later, I'm still downloading, so I guess I'm hooked. Despite my occasional disagreements with you, and especially with Michael, who drives me nuts every time he dismisses Kubrick post-2001.
He does like to do that, doesn't he?
For the most part, I find your conversation stimulating and informative. I've learned a lot, and now keep a running notepad of movies to catch up with. So thanks for that. Even though sometimes I dislike things you recommend, I'm still glad to have seen them. And the works of filmmakers like Truffaut and Bertolucci have been a revelation.
We also got these comments from our Silver Club donor, Luke Hext, in Melbourne, Australia. He says, "Hi, guys. I love the annual countdown list more than any other, and 1993 could possibly be the best year for film that I can find. The possibility of getting involved in that discussion nudged me over the line, so with my first donation comes my first top five list. Unfortunately, being born in 1990 has its drawbacks. We don't want to hear it, Luke. And while I've caught up with a few films from that year, there are quite a few on my need-to-see list. That being said, my top five are as follows." We're going to list the first four here. He's got Homeward Bound at number five, The Sandlot, number four, Schindler's List, number three, and In the Name of the Father, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Pete Postlethwaite, at his number two slot. His number one, though, is Philadelphia.
Truth be told, Luke says, there were better films from 1993, but Neil Young's song Philadelphia playing over the home movie ending is one of the most emotional scenes I've ever experienced in film. It rocked me to my core, and a film that does gets my number one any day of the week. Honorable mentions go especially to What's Eating Gilbert Grape and Groundhog Day, but also include The Fugitive and Shortcuts. Unfortunately, I have yet to see any of Dazed and Confused. I can't imagine that. Fearless, The Man Without a Face, The Nightmare Before Christmas, The Piano, Red Rock West, and Three Colors Blue. All are films that I have wanted to see for a long time, but just haven't managed to get around to. Anyway, tell Michael I said hi, as his visits are always my favorite episodes, and keep up the great work with the rest of the shows.
A lot of love for Michael Phillips this week. That doesn't mean we're going to share any of this money with him. I just want everyone to know that. Though we do occasionally like to buy Michael a dinner or two, so it does go to good use. We'll close with these comments from Riley in PA. He says, "My name's Riley Geis, and I'm currently a sophomore at a Southern Californian film school that shall remain nameless. I have your show to blame for helping me make the jump across the nation into the world capital of commercial filmmaking. That is why, for my recent 19th birthday, I've decided the dealer must be paid. A measly sum for a broke college kid, but I need to thank you for all the hours of film talk that restored my faith in good old film deconstruction. After many film classes, listening to constant trash talk on anything made after 1924 that grossed over $1 million, you guys keep it fresh, lively, and a ton of fun. That is why, for the past 9 months, some friends and I went outside the school's curriculum, garnered enough graduation, babysitting, lifeguarding, and alcohol money, and made ourselves a feature film. It's entitled The Cult of Persuasion, a thriller based off an incident that happened to my friend while pledging a fraternity." So Riley, hoping in exchange for his donation, he could get a film spotting mention here. The website is cultofpersuasion.com. You can view the entire feature film there. And Riley says, "Let's hope the lessons I've learned listening to film spotting over the years have been applied well in the film. We can be the judge."
Wow, pressure there.
Best of luck, Riley. Thanks so much for the kind words, and congrats on your film. No matter how good it is, the fact that you've pulled it off at 19 is an achievement in its own right. Again, our thanks to Riley and all of our wonderful donors this week. We appreciate all the comments we get from you. Quick note about our music this week. You probably recognized it. In keeping with our 1993 theme, you heard in the first break, The Heart Asks Pleasure First from Michael Nyman's soundtrack to Jane Campion's The Piano.
So good.
It is very good. And John Williams' very memorable theme there from Jurassic Park. Also wanted to throw out a plug for our buddy Jeff Goldsmith and his Q&A podcast.
Last week, he had a really fun interview with Iron Man 3 co-writer Drew Pearce and co-writer-director Shane Black. Just type the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith in iTunes and you'll be able to find it. Also, if you haven't already checked out Jeff's new digital magazine, Backstory, the iPad app is free, and so is the first issue, issue 01. Jeff's already on to issue 08, actually. It just came out, and that's where you'll be able to find entire screenplays. You can check out script excerpts and read interviews with today's top storytellers. Now, right now, Backstory is only available on the iPad, but it's going to be online soon. The site for that is backstory.net, so just keep an eye out for it there.
Hey there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. This is Allison Wilmore from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And this week on the show, Matt Singer and I fondly remember that one magical weekend when we and our high school buddies hung out at a beautiful ranch and then were brutally murdered one by one as we review All the Boys Love Mandy Lane.
Inspired by Mandy Lane, we'll also recommend some other movies available online for streaming or rental that spent significant periods of time sitting on a shelf somewhere waiting for a release. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Suppose I were to offer you $1 million for one night with your wife.
I'd assume you're kidding.
Let's pretend I'm not. What would you say?
He'd tell you to go to hell.
I didn't hear him.
I tell you to go to hell.
You're listening to Film Spotting. How can you do the top five films of 1993 and not play a scene from that Adrian Lyne classic, Indecent Proposal?
Classic. You're going
Why
classic.
Not? Of course, Robert Redford there, Woody Harrelson, Demi Moore also in the movie. And alas, Indecent Proposal, not going to make my top five, but it did make a semi-honorable mention category for me, Josh, which is Guilty Pleasures from 1993. I don't feel that guilty about.
No?
Indecent Proposal is one of them. The other one is Tombstone, which is a movie I happen to adore with Val Kilmer and Kurt Russell. So those two not going to make this list. And before we get to the picks that did make our list, I guess maybe we should explain why the hell we're talking about films from 1993.
Why not?
Well, why not? That's one answer. The second answer would be these movies are celebrating their 20-year anniversary.
Yikes.
So there's a little bit of a hook there, yes, and that does make us feel very old. But the third reason is this is something we do here on Film Spotting. We haven't done one in a long time, but we like to do these year-by-year countdowns because the show started in 2005. So every year from 2005 up to 2012, we've shared our top 10 films of the year on the show. So what we did starting maybe 4 or 5 years ago was go back to 2004, the year before the show started, and count backwards and do our top five from these years. And we share all these lists under the top five link at filmspotting.net. But Josh, I don't know if I've been able to talk you into one of these, except for there were tie-ins with other shows. Like when we talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark, we did our favorite films of 81.
Right.
And I think we did our favorite films of 86.
We did 94 for the 94. Sacred Cow review of Pulp Fiction.
That's it.
Yeah, you do like these
I do.
Lists. I'm a little apprehensive
like
about them. I know, and I understand why they like them. As a listener, I would like to hear them too. But putting them together is a little daunting for me because sometimes I feel like I just haven't seen enough films. You know, you put a lot of film viewing in to make a top 10 list every year now.
True.
I wasn't doing that this long ago. So, but all that being said, I looked back on the movies that came out in 93. What a rich year.
Yeah,
I mean,
very good year.
It was hard to choose among the ones I had seen and really appreciated.
Well, you joked that it was a formative year for us, but it really was for me because not only was I at that point 17, 18, where I was graduating from high school. Obviously, that's a big year when you graduate from high school, but also in terms of my being smitten with cinema, that had really just happened the summer before the year I graduated. The summer of 92 was the year I really discovered my love for movies. So these movies were really important to me, though. With that said, I went back and realized, Josh, that I think only one film on my list I actually saw in 1993.
In 93, really?
I think maybe 94 or later in 93 when it was out on DVD, but I only saw one of these films in the theater the year it came out.
Yeah, all of mine, I'm looking at the list right now, I did see then and have seen since.
Okay.
So a little bit different perspective.
Well, let's hear your number five.
So number five, it's not the most surprising pick. I wanted to try to find something else, did a little viewing to see if something else could slip in here, but I had to go with Schindler's List. I mean, if you take the Oscar wins and the Spielberg name away and just look at the film, it's very difficult for me to not put it among the top five. This was really a turning point, I think, for Spielberg in his career because it finally merged his filmmaking talents with this desire to be taken seriously that I think we probably first saw around 1985 with The Color Purple. And that led to complications. Some of his other attempts weren't quite as successful in making one of these prestige pictures. Here, it works. Schindler's List has this documentary-like distance from its story, which is the true account of a Polish factory owner who comes to protect his Jewish employees while under Nazi occupation. The filmmaking flourishes here. They're applied sparingly. I'm thinking of the little girl in the red coat, rather than overwhelmingly, which they often can be in Spielberg pictures, to good effects. But I think that would have been the wrong way to go here. And so he knows how to pull back those reins in just the right way. This is certainly a prestige picture, as I said, but maybe what's the most impressive thing about it is the way Spielberg's talent here, it allows him to make a prestige picture that's alive and honest as well.
Herr Kommandant, the entire foundation has to be torn down and repoured. If not, there will be at least a subsidence at the southern end of the barracks. Subsidence and then collapse.
You are an engineer?
Yes. My name is Diana Reiter. I'm a graduate of civil engineering from the University of Milan.
I'm an educated Jew, like Karl Marx himself. Unterschaffiere.
Jawohl.
Shoot her.
Herr Kommandant, I'm only trying to do my job.
Yeah, I'm doing mine.
Well, Schindler's List is for me like another Holocaust film, The Pianist from Roman Polanski, a one-timer. It's a movie I've only seen once, and I probably only need to see once, and that maybe isn't fair, because it's a very good film, and I think there are a lot of rewards there, but the fact is, it's just not subject matter I really want to
And I can
turn
understand,
myself over
but
to
but I
again.
Think to appreciate, like I said, the levels of riches in the film, multiple viewings, that's the case for any film, but especially here, to get past the subject matter, to get past, like I said, the Oscars, the reputation, to get past the reputation and into the film itself is really important with this.
Yeah, the Ralph Fiennes performance really is. You want to talk about monsters on screen.
Yeah.
He is mesmerizing. And that film, you mentioned the word prestige. Another honorable mention for me, prestige pictures I really like, but didn't make my top five, Schindler's List and Philadelphia, the film starring Tom Hanks. My number five is a film I've never written about or talked about. I don't think it's ever been discussed in any detail on the show or even made a top five. I haven't seen it since, I think, maybe the year after it came out in theaters. So I'm just going on the fact that I remember loving this movie, and it's Robert Altman's Shortcuts. The sweep of this movie, those interconnected stories, I think there's like 22 different characters in the movie. And when you think of Altman, you think about those great ensemble casts. You think about his great use of dialogue. And that whole interconnected thing has been done a lot since Shortcuts. It's probably been done before, too, if I really go back and look at my film history. But I don't know if it's been done any better than it is here in Shortcuts. The way Altman does fit it all together in a way that, going back to our discussion of Short Term 12, doesn't necessarily feel too neat and tidy. And as I was thinking about Altman, I was thinking about our discussion of 2001 last week on the show and the week before, all the focus on Stanley Kubrick and his sense of human frailty. I think about that a lot with Robert Altman as well. He really is a director who some people find too misanthropic. They find him too cynical and maybe has too much of a dark sense of humor and can be patronizing. I don't see Altman that way. I think there is some real humanity there, but it's a fun question to consider as you watch his movies. And Shortcuts is one of those films that does find those comedic moments amidst a lot of darkness, or at least some grim subject matter, and certainly human frailty you see on display in that movie. So again, one I'd love to revisit still just based on what I remember of it, good enough to make my top five.
Yeah, I think we were lucky to be just getting into movies, or at least only have been doing that for a couple of years around that time in regards to Altman, because we had The Player. That was my first Altman film I'd ever seen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then I remember, you know, I went out to see Shortcuts because of that in the theater in 93, and a good renaissance time to discover that particular filmmaker. My number four is Three Colors Blue. It's the first in Krzysztof Kieslowski's Three Colors trilogy, with Juliette Binoche as a wife and mother who survives a car accident in which her husband and daughter are killed. Now, her response to this is to cut all ties to her former life, and she goes out and begins this anonymous new life. But this isn't really out of any sort of sense of freedom that she's pursuing, which the structure of the film might suggest, but rather it's sort of a stunted form of mourning that she's experiencing here. This is really a mournful film. I mean, everything from the color scheme to the score. Binoche's character's husband was a composer, so much of the film's music comes from one of his pieces. And the actual composer for the film's music was regular Kieslowski collaborator Zbigniew Preisner. Now, Binoche, of course, she can perfectly embody this sort of purgatory state, even without saying a word. I'd probably name this the best performance by an actress in 93, except for another film I'll get to later.
Okay. Well, she also has competition depending on how you look at the films and when they came out chronologically, but the Three Colors film Red, starring Irene Jacob, that might be an even better performance in one of those Three Colors films, but Binoche is so spectacular, and that's a great film. So good, I don't have a cleverly named category for it. It's just my number six. It's the movie I really, really wanted to find a place for and probably could have, but I also had a feeling you were going to go with it, so left it just off. My number four is the movie that somehow finished dead last in our Which Film from 1993 Do You Save? Poll question. It is True Romance, and you talk about Robert Altman. You talk about his use of ensembles and those great actors and great character actors. A lot of people you don't necessarily always think of as the biggest stars, but are fun to see those faces in a Robert Altman film. Well, True Romance is also full of those kind of people. Some stars, some not so much stars. But yes, you get Dennis Hopper. You get Christopher Walken. But Val Kilmer, Gary Oldman, Brad Pitt, the two stars of the film I think are very good, Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette. But he also loves seeing those faces show up near the end, like Tom Sizemore, Chris Penn, James Gandolfini. So great cast. And going back to that poll question, when you do think of this in terms of, okay, you can only save five films from 1993, you're saying these are the best. If you pretend all other ones are going to be destroyed, what are you keeping? Well, I'm keeping True Romance because not only do I want to hang on to Gary Oldman's spivey pimp character, I do want to save that Sicilian scene.
You know, Sicilians are great liars. Best in the world. I'm Sicilian. My father was the world heavyweight champion of Sicilian liars. From growing up with him, I learned the pantomime. There are 17 different things a guy can do when he lies to give himself away. Guy's got 17 pantomimes. Woman's got 20. Guy's got 17. But if you know them like you know your own face, they'd be lie detectors all to hell. Now, what we got here is a little game of show and tell. You don't want to show me nothing, but you tell me everything.
That scene that is such a Tarantino scene, that dialogue between Walken and Hopper, is so much fun to watch because, like you get with so many good Tarantino films, there's so much tension built out of just two people sitting across from each other having a conversation. It's that Elmore Leonard approach to storytelling we talked about on our recent tribute to him, where the tension comes from seeing where the story is going to go, a character employing a story to great effect, and then the response to it. You also see in Tarantino's writing there the casual racism or not so casual racism of the characters, maybe Tarantino as well, depending on your perspective. And Walken and Hopper are just giving a masterclass, I think. The reaction when Walken first hears Dennis Hopper question his ancestry is really priceless stuff. And I think watching Hopper, too, it goes beyond just being Josh for me, just a lot of fun Tarantino dialogue and them having fun with the scene. You see in Hopper some real layers there where he's defending his son. He's trying to protect his son's whereabouts. And you recognize in his face very early on the fact that he recognizes he's going to die. That no matter what he says here, he's not coming out of this alive. And watching that character go through that realization on screen is something pretty profound, I think. And he at least decides, I'm going to go out on my terms. And boy, does he ever.
You're Sicilian, huh?
Sicilian.
You know, I read a lot. Especially about things, about history. I find that shit fascinating. Here's a fact, I don't know whether you know or not. Well, Sicilians were spawned by niggas.
Come again?
it's a fact.
Yeah, I haven't seen True Romance since 93, so it's hard for me to say. My instinct is that I feel like I might have outgrown it if I watched it now. Just memories of it, as you're talking about those scenes, it seems like a parade of scene stealers, which has its entertainment value. But the one movie I'd want to keep, I don't know, I'd probably be looking for something
more.
Well,
it is number four for me, Josh, but True Romance for me, a movie I didn't see until probably just about 6 or 7 years ago.
That's what I was wondering. When was the last time you saw it? Interesting.
All right. I guess I'm just more juvenile than you.
Obviously. My number three, speaking of juvenile, Groundhog Day, or maybe not, because this is the Bill Murray comedy that people often point to as a comedy that's doing so much more. I mean, the big questions are here. Who am I? Why am I here? What is my place in the time-space continuum? You know, it's great when the big filmmakers, the Ingmar Bergmans or the Stanley Kubricks, consider these questions. But I get a special kick out of it when a genre film does this, something like even Rian Johnson's Looper from last year, you know, a sci-fi action movie that asks some of these questions. And here we get Bill Murray as Phil Connors doing the same thing. Connors is this arrogant weatherman who's covering the annual appearance of Punxsutawney Phil, and he finds himself in a time loop that's repeating the same day over and over and over again. So it's a wonderful comic exaggeration of our own everyday existential angst, I think, about life as this never-ending routine. We can hook into that right away and understand that. And there's a release valve here, too, because this is a comedy. But really, I think this movie works because of Murray. And watching some clips, it's been a while since I've seen it, and watching some clips made me realize how another actor in a lot of these scenes, this wouldn't have been anything special at all,
no.
Probably. But he has, you know, he has the self-loathing that we often see from him. Yet this is one of those few films that allows him a way out of that and manages to reach it without being sappy, at least to me. Even though it does go in that direction, I think it handles it really well.
I think people place too much emphasis on their careers. Gosh, I wish we could all live in the mountains at high altitudes. That's where I see myself in 5 years. How about you?
Oh, I agree. I just like to go with the flow.
Yeah?
See what happens.
Well, it's gotten you here.
Uh-huh. Of course, it's a million miles from where I started out in college.
Oh, yeah? You weren't in broadcasting or journalism, anything like that?
Believe it or not, I studied 19th century French poetry.
La fille qui j'aimera sera comme bon vin. Que c'est bon fiera un peu chaque matin.
You speak French.
Oui. This is also a movie that's grown in reputation. I know Roger Ebert, for one, initially gave it a mildly positive review, and then eventually he included it in one of his great movies books. So I think a lot of people have come around to appreciate it that way, and our poll suggests they certainly did.
Yeah, and maybe it's the push of many of our film spotting listeners that have made me regard it a little more highly, though I always enjoyed it. It was a movie that whenever it came on, I got pleasure out of, and I remember liking it when I saw it the first time. Groundhog Day might be one that I did actually see in the theater in 1993. It might be in my top 10 of that year, but just behind Indecent Proposal.
Oh, no way.
I think...
Come on.
I had to get that dig in there. My number three, if we're talking about things we're going to save, and I'm going to try to save Gary Oldman and the Sicilian scene from True Romance, my number four, I don't want to lose the character Johnny, played by David Thewlis in Mike Leigh's film Naked. That's my number three choice for film of 1993. He made my top five Gonzo characters a little while back on the show, and I was thinking about him.
I believe that was my first show ever.
Yeah, it might have been. And he actually makes me think a lot of another character we discussed recently on the show, and that's Kate Blanchett's character from Blue Jasmine. That might actually make a good double feature, though. I like the movie Naked more, but they're similarly self-destructive characters. They're lost characters. They come to rely on friends or family members to try to put them up as they're looking for a place to kind of call home temporarily, and they never can quite seem to find a home. They just are constantly adrift and can't really survive in society. They're also both, for lack of a more appropriate term, slightly crazy. I mean, they clearly have some mental issues that they're dealing with, as well as superiority issues. And I mentioned frailty talking about Kubrick. Wow, that's really on display in Mike Leigh's work, especially in Naked. These characters really unable to connect. They want to with others. You sense that in Johnny, and I think that's what makes you empathize with him, even though he's a monster, and he does some things on screen that really just can't be forgiven. But at least in him, you recognize that he wants, I think, to connect, but is his own worst enemy. And I saw an interview with David Thewlis where he talked about that character, how he was a hard one to play because it did really put him in touch with a lot of his own anger, and he had to kind of get that out of his system. And you get that sense watching the performance that he really would have had to tap in to some of that. And he mentioned something about seeing in that character, or the character seeing in the world, this absence of compassion he senses in the world. But then that just makes him so angry that he doesn't have any compassion himself. You know, there's this kind of hypocrisy about him. He makes you think a lot, of course, of Holden Caulfield and Catcher in the Rye. That same sense of, well, the whole world's phony and fake. Well, then it turns out he's probably just as phony, if not more so, because he lets that resentment build up in him so much. So I do love that character and that film, Mike Leaves Naked. Another one I didn't see until pretty recently, I think maybe as I was preparing for my interview with Mike Lee 4 years or so ago, 5 years ago here on the show. I finally did catch up with it, but great movie.
So would you describe yourself as a happy little person?
Yeah, I'm the life and soul.
Have you ever thought, right? I mean, you don't know, but you might already have had the happiest moment in your whole f***ing life, and all you've got to look forward to is sickness and purgatory.
Oh, shit. Oh. I just live from day to day myself.
I tend to skip a day now and again, you know what I mean? I used to be a werewolf, but I'm all right. No!
No.
Naked, not exactly a family film.
No.
But I'm going to go that direction with my number two. It's Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas. Burton provided the original poem and drawings, but it was stop-motion specialist Henry Selick who brought this macabre movie musical to thrilling life. The basic plot here, it's a stroke of imaginative genius. Jack Skellington, the Pumpkin King of Halloween Town, grows tired of his spooky duties, so he decides to fill in for Santa Claus one Christmas. And of course, he's not the skeleton for the job. Now, Halloween Town was my choice earlier this year for our top five movie locations we'd like to visit. It's just this dismally gorgeous place, down to the tiniest, most gruesome detail. So much visual wit packed into every frame here. Sally, who's Jack's love interest, she keeps having to sew her arms and legs back on. I love how she just considers it a minor annoyance. You also get wonderful songs by Danny Elfman, of course. Nightmare Before Christmas, it's required holiday viewing in our house. And the great thing about it is you can watch it twice a year, Christmas and Halloween.
Well, film spotting confession, I've never seen it.
Watch it with the kids.
No, I've never seen it. And it's funny you say that, because recently on our vacation back in August on our family trip, one night I plugged in the laptop to the television and we pulled up Netflix Instant, and the kids wanted to watch, and I think they've seen it before, which is why they wanted to watch it. The kids wanted to watch The Nightmare Before Christmas, and it started, and we got like 3 minutes into it, and it was just one of those things where we couldn't keep a good connection.
Oh, no.
And we couldn't watch it. We had to stop it.
You missed your shot.
That would have been my opportunity, and I blew it. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam. We're sharing our top five films of 1993. It's part of our year-by-year countdowns here on the show. 20 years ago, these movies came out, and my number two is an obvious one to anyone who's been listening to this show for some time. It is The Remains of the Day, the Merchant Ivory production that I love, maybe the only Merchant Ivory production I truly love. And I mentioned Naked, my number three, oddly comparable as I was writing down my notes about Remains of the Day, in the sense that you've got there two unique, isolated worlds being explored. The lower class society, where you don't normally see much on screen, and those characters in Mike Lee's world. But then here in Remains of the Day, that high class society, the aristocracy, the ultra rich. And again, characters longing to connect, but who can't, and who are kind of their own worst enemies, whether it's madness or a sense of superiority that keeps them from it in Naked, or in this movie, the sense of duty, which for whatever reason, Remains of the Day really has always drawn me to this picture. I just find it such a romantic, heartbreaking movie. Of course, it's got two of the finest actors around in Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. And there are so many scenes I love, but one that really sticks out to me, Josh, is the one with the book, where Emma Thompson catches Anthony Hopkins reading a story and starts to tease him a little bit and wonders if the book is maybe something racy, because he won't show her what he's reading. He won't share it with her.
What's in that book? Come on, let me see. Or are you protecting me? Is that what you're doing? Would I be shocked? Would it ruin my character? Let me see it.
And the way Anthony Hopkins retreats into the corner while she's talking to him, like a little boy, where he's just trying to hide and try to shield himself in the corner, the closer he gets to her. And then when it's revealed that the book isn't racy at all, what does he say? Well, I read to edify myself.
I read these books. Any books to develop my command and knowledge of the English language. I read to further my education, Miss Kenton.
And of course, is this sense that it's part of his duty to better himself, and that's why he reads. It would certainly be for nothing as tawdry as pleasure. And that scene, especially as you see the closer they get to each other, it's the most physical contact they have. It's the closest they come to ever consummating their feelings for each other. But there's that sense with Hopkins' character, he just can't take the risk. He's just not willing to put himself out there. It's better to stifle those feelings and focus on his work, which he can control, than take a chance and possibly be rebuked. And something about that fear and that trepidation in that character, and again, the sense of longing that they're never able to consummate. For whatever reason, in 1993, this is the one movie I definitely saw in the theaters, and still, when I catch up with it now, I still have those same feelings of heartbreak. I just love The Remains of the Day.
My number one is the real reason why I was excited about doing this list, because I finally will get a chance to talk about The Piano. It's writer-director Jane Campion's masterpiece. To my mind, it really is one of the greats. It's set in 1850s New Zealand, where a mute woman has been sent as part of an arranged marriage to live with this wealthy landowner, and she takes along her prized piano, which is going to figure into much of the ensuing story. So Holly Hunter is, of course, in the role, the lead role of Ada, and she's just devastating here. What's especially shocking to realize is, remember how crucial her motor mouth was in Raising Arizona to making
or
that
broadcast
performance,
news.
Broadcast news, to making those work? And she doesn't have that tool here. She doesn't have it at all, goes a completely different direction and gives what I think is an even better performance than those. I think about her face in that scene where she loses her finger. I'm not going to say how, but just the unnerving defiance that sets in there always really jars me. Now, this isn't just an acting showcase, though. Even though Hunter and Anna Paquin as Ada's daughter both won Oscars, I do think it's the definitive example of Campion's ethereal sense of composition. I mean, she brings that otherworldliness to even the most ordinary of settings in so many of her films. I think of the recent Netflix series, Top of the Lake, but it's emphasized even more here in this natural landscape, very watery, like Top of the Lake again, and just at the end of the world for that time. It's a perfect fit. There's just so much else that's good about this movie. Michael Nyman's piano score, a disarmingly gentle Harvey Keitel as this neighbor who takes piano lessons from Ada. And that sort of leads to an amazingly complicated handling of sexuality. It's the sort we rarely get at the movies. Now, I saw something fairly distressing on Letterboxd, Adam. there was someone named Adam Kempinar who gave this, I think, 2.5 out of 5 stars. Please tell me. You didn't shrug off this movie.
Yeah, maybe I was just too excited to lay into it a little bit because I knew it was going to be your number one. But The Piano was the movie that I knew of all the movies I need to see from 1993 still. It was the one I knew I had to see before forming this list, or I just would have felt too guilty. And I watched it, and I have to say, everything you described that's good about the film is good about the film. Holly Hunter is amazing. I'd also say Anna Paquin's amazing. I really like Sam Neill in it. Harvey Keitel, I'm not quite as sold on. Hunter's performance, the face, all those things are great. The music is great. But you talk about sexuality, Josh, to me, watching this film. And I'm curious, let me ask you real quick first. Have you rewatched this movie since you saw it originally?
Yeah.
How recently?
Probably seen it 3 times.
Okay.
And maybe the last time it's probably been more than 5 years ago.
Because really my sense of it now, and I'm going to try to not be too dismissive here and make this sound like I'm suggesting you were the one being too juvenile. But my sense watching The Piano for the first time just a couple nights ago was that if I saw it in 1993, I would have loved it. As I was just discovering cinema and I was watching this real art house film that seemed really challenging to me in the way it was playing with sexuality, in the way the plotting is really loose and incoherent and doesn't spell a lot of things out, I probably would have really thought that was fascinating in 1993.
Wait, I don't remember that.
Watching it now, I don't feel that way at all. I actually feel like it's kind of a mess. And in particular, what bugged me about it is some of the things you talked about in terms of the view of sexuality. I think the movie thinks it's a lot more transgressive and daring than it really is. Nothing about the sexual intimations or those scenes, the piano lesson scenes, they didn't strike me as racy, not passionate, not confounding in a fascinating way. I mean, they didn't make me think about anything. They actually just didn't work for me at all.
I don't think it's going for any sort of transgressive sense of sexuality.
So?
No, it's
well,
just
described
it's
that it's,
complicated is the word I used.
I think it those are the it's scenes, more complicated than it is.
Those, no way. Those are the scenes that are talked about because Harvey Keitel is new to them. That this one small element of it is their interrelationship. Sex also here is very much a tool of power when
without
you think of how Sam Neill uses it.
Yeah.
And it's very complicated even in how Ada uses it as a form of communication. When does it finally become something that's actual intimacy for relationship? And I think that the Harvey Keitel character is very intriguing here in how what seems to be exploitative, and in some ways is, it's also very crucial to the fact that his listening to her while mm-hmm. she plays the piano, the sexuality is a part of that. But think about the fact that he's actually listening to her.
Right.
He's the only man in this time and in this situation and probably in her whole experience who gives her the space to listen. And the fact that sexuality
really
is a part of that, the fact that he's also exploiting her is part of the complication I'm talking about. So it isn't just some romantic notion of sex.
Certainly not. But I would still argue for me, it's a movie that seems a lot more complicated in those romantic
How
and sexual
all of that
relationships.
Not complicated, though?
It seems complicated compared to a lot of Hollywood films, but I don't think it's complicated at all compared to a lot of other great films that we could name here. It didn't strike me as anything
wow.
interesting. I'll be honest with you. Nothing about the
Sex
sexual dynamics.
Sex and Campion's films is as complicated as in any other pictures you'll see, hmm. and this is a prime example of
didn't
it.
Didn't feel that here, unfortunately, but let's get to a film I think we can agree on, though. It hasn't come up yet, so it clearly didn't make your top five. My number one, yes, this is Linklater Nation. I'm planting the flagpole.
Not to indulge in any alcohol, drugs, sex after 12, or any other illegal activity.
God, my shadow.
Slater, baby. Found that in your glove compartment, man.
You know you're the third person who's given me this today? God.
But what do you reckon you're gonna do?
I don't know, man. I'll probably end up signing it. I just don't want to give in so easy.
Man, it's the same bullshit they tried to pull in my day. You know, if it ain't that piece of paper, some other choice they're gonna try and make for you. You gotta do what Randall Pink Floyd wants to do, man. Let me tell you this. The older you do get, the more rules are gonna try to get you to follow. You just gotta keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
I'm going with Dazed and Confused, and it's a movie that I didn't see in 1993, and I saw later a couple times, always liked it, but it was only really recently, seeing it maybe in the past year or two, where I recognized a real profound appreciation for the movie and what Linklater is doing with the film. It elevated above it being just a really good, entertaining time. I actually think it's an essential film, and it was appropriate that just recently I was listening to Olivia Wilde on The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell. It's a really good interview. I do recommend it. And they're talking about her film Drinking Buddies, which I've recommended here on the show, the one from Joe Swanberg. And that timing was perfect because as I was thinking about this list and hearing that interview, Drinking Buddies is another movie I wouldn't put quite up there with Dazed and Confused, but it's another one that you can describe, and I did on the show, as a movie that just gets the moments right. It feels so authentic, Josh, that term that we discussed in the opening of the show. It just feels so genuine. And the more I think about that, I'm always struggling whenever I write down that as praise for a film. What does that really mean? It seems like there should be some better way to articulate a strength of a movie than to say it feels real. Because the fact is, there are a lot of filmmakers and writers who use dialogue in ways that don't feel real at all. And I love those guys, too. I love Aaron Sorkin's dialogue. I love Tarantino's dialogue, Mamet's dialogue, the Coen brothers. I don't know that you describe any of those filmmakers as being particularly real.
Or think of classic Hollywood. I mean, if we put
exactly.
that standard
Screwball
on classic
comedies,
Hollywood, right.
You're right. And so I love all that, too. So why is it that I can just pass off, oh, well, Drinking Buddies felt real. This movie, Dazed and Confused, feels real. I still haven't come up with a completely acceptable answer for myself, but I guess what I can say is that some movies just hit on something so specific that the characters and the stories do become universal. And there's something about Dazed and Confused capturing that sort of last night of revelry for a lot of these people, some going from junior high to high school, others coming out of high school and trying to figure out what they're going to do in their senior years or beyond. It feels so loose it feels like it's 24 hours, but it's sprawling and you're following all these different character threads. But when you watch it again, you can really appreciate how Linklater structures the movie and how all these storylines deal with these characters embarking on adulthood and trying to wrestle with this notion of individuality as they become adults and whether or not that's something they can retain. You certainly see that in the Mitch character becoming a man, Adam Goldberg and the fight at the end, Pink, the main character, of course, Randall Pink Floyd, and that sheet of paper that he just doesn't want to sign. And that question keeps coming up over and over again. Well, who cares? Just sign it and then do whatever you want. Why does it really matter? And it does matter to him because it feels false. It just feels wrong to him. And I love that at one point he says about the football coaches, he thinks it's because they just want everyone to sign it because they think the kids are having too much fun. And he might actually be right, that this whole idea the movie's dealing with about becoming an adult, becoming a man, may involve giving up that sense of fun. It's something not all these characters want to do, and maybe they shouldn't. And part of fun is retaining some sense of your individual identity that is important. So you think about Dazed and Confused in 1993, Josh. You look back at a film like American Graffiti, 1973. So every 20 years or so, maybe we just need another movie like this. And it's 2013 now. So where's our American Graffiti / Dazed and Confused? And can we even have it? Do kids hang out this way anymore? Do they drive around the town anymore and actually interact in these kind of interpersonal ways? I don't know. I'm not a kid. I haven't been one for a while, but I think we're due for another Dazed and Confused. I'd like to see how it manifests itself on screen now.
Can I propose that it should probably be the Facebook movie we didn't get with The Social Network, which for all its virtues was not really a Facebook movie.
Exactly.
In my mind. And I wonder, you know, certainly if you're going to look at how kids have these relationships now, it's going to be online largely. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see if that comes about.
I don't know if that's been done either yet or not. If it has, we haven't seen it. So I agree with you. That'd be something interesting to see explored on screen. Those are our top five films in 1993. What about any honorable mentions, Josh?
Yeah, Dazed and Confused was one jostling for that number six place for sure. I also caught up with Fearless for the first time. Somehow I had missed Peter Weir's elliptical spiritual drama about a guy who survives a plane crash and then thinks he's invincible. Jeff Bridges is really good in that role. Iron Monkey was a martial arts film directed by the grandmaster action choreographer Yen-Wo Ping. That was really good. A Perfect World is an underknown but really strong Clint Eastwood drama starring Kevin Costner. Farewell, My Concubine. This was a prestige picture, if there ever was one. Chen Kaiga's Cannes-winning costume epic. Menace to Society came out, the Hughes Brothers debut. And one more.
A lot of movies here, Josh.
One more. I saw a lot of movies in 93. All my college money apparently went to the theater. Matinee, the affectionate showbiz spoof starring John Goodman as a 1960s film pioneer. It's directed by the underrated Joe Dante. All right,
well,
your turn.
I have already mentioned six of my honorable mentions, so I'll give you four more that haven't come up somehow. Good action movies from 1993. And I know a lot of people out there are screaming right now, The Fugitive, how can it not be in your top five? I think The Fugitive is a really good movie. And Jurassic Park, even though, as I wrote on Letterboxd recently, I think it's maybe a little bit overrated by a lot of film spotting listeners, it's still a really good action movie. And I do think it at least deserves an honorable mention. Two others that I think are overlooked films from 1993 that, Josh, you didn't say. King of the Hill, the Steven Soderbergh film. I actually really do like that movie from him. And The War Room, the documentary about Bill Clinton's run to the presidency and kind of the behind the scenes of the communications and everything about that campaign, made James Carville and George Stephanopoulos stars. That's a really fascinating documentary as well. So many good options to choose from if you are thinking about going back and revisiting the year 1993. We want to hear your picks or any other comments about the show. You can send those to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You could also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, the new film Baggage Claim, starring Paula Patton and Taye Diggs, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, which my kids have already vowed they're going to drag me
to, Josh.
They're
going to take you to that, huh?
Don John, the film written, directed, and starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It stars Scarlett Johansson and Rush, the Ron Howard-directed film of the 70s-era Formula One rivals James Hunt and Niki Lauda. Chris Hemsworth is the star, and Daniel Brühl, who is really good as the German sniper in Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. Good to see him on screen again. That's a movie I do want to see, if not one we're necessarily going to discuss here on the show.
Yeah, I can be a Ron Howard apologist.
I can too.
Can't generate much interest for this, though. Sorry.
Okay. In limited release, opening here in Chicago, Blue Caprice, a drama about the relationship between the two men who committed the 2002 Beltway sniper attacks, and Computer Chess. This is an acclaimed indie. It comes from Andrew Bujalski. It's set in the 1980s at a chess tournament, and it's a movie I've mentioned on the show previously, I've seen, and one I plan to rewatch before forming my top 10 of the year, because there's something there. There really is something there. I'm just not sure, Josh, I completely got it. And finally, Enough Said. This is the latest film from Nicole Holofcener. It stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Catherine Keener, of course, Catherine Keener, and James Gandolfini. A lot of people I know looking forward to seeing Enough Said, strictly for that reason, to see Gandolfini back on screen.
One of my most anticipated of the fall.
Next week here on the show, we will share our Chicago International Film Festival preview. We'll count down our top five most anticipated movies of the fest. We'll also get to the third movie in our Korean auteurs marathon, I'm a Cyborg and That's Okay, from the director of Old Boy and Stoker. We may have another review on the show, just hasn't been completely ironed out yet.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.